You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Follow me online on Parler. That's P-A-R-L-E-R, the app, at Jackie Daly Show on Instagram and on Facebook. And, of course, Twitter, if you must. If you must. I'm trying to get off of it, trying to wean myself, because I just don't care for the policies. But until that day, yes, Twitter, at Jackie Daly Show, or at Jackie Daly Host. Coming up, I'm going to explain to you in my monologue why we can know that Vladimir Putin and Russia are not supporting Donald Trump for president. Why we know they didn't support him in 2016. Why we know they will not support him this time. Why we know that they would much prefer to compete in a world governed by either Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden. I've talked about this at length before. It might be time for an op-ed because I feel like nobody in the press is talking about the obvious reason why Russia would oppose Trump, who has hit the accelerator on U.S. oil and gas production, which, as you know, is pretty much the only product that Russia sells, tanking the price of those commodities while his opponents vow to destroy U.S. oil and gas any way they can. This is a life or death issue for the Russians. This is not, you know, this is not kind of a throwaway issue at the bottom of the polls that no one cares about. Like, you know, are we going to run on solar or wind or fossil fuels? Americans are so superficial on these polls compared to the life or death situation that a petrostate faces with the United States flooding the world with oil and natural gas, bringing down the price, destroying the budgets of these other countries. You know, the Russians need $65 a barrel just to make their budget. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, okay? Venezuela needs $359 a barrel. Iran needs $91 a barrel. Saudi Arabia needs $94 a barrel. That's not going to happen unless Iran and Saudi Arabia go to war. Anyway, I have a lot more to say about that, but maybe it's time to write this up because it's not getting attention, but it really must. Okay, I'm going to speak with Chuck DeVore, my favorite op-ed writer, Chuck DeVore, on his piece, California Blackouts Display the Results of Kamala Harris's Favored Energy Policy. It's awesome. It's awesome. Chuck always gets it right. He used to be a state legislator in California. He's actually a foreign policy expert, and he's the director of national initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And he's always fun. You know, I love to read his stuff because it's like a treat. He's part comedian, if you understand him. He's fantastic. So he's back on the show. And also Jason Isaac will be here. He is as well the director of the Life Powered Initiative. And he is going to tell us the three reasons that American energy dominance benefits your life. Because, again, when we get into geopolitics, it just seems like eyes glaze over. There is a very real reason, in fact, many of them, why you as an American, no matter who you are, right? You don't have to be working in oil and gas. You might be a mother who has children that you don't want to deploy to the Middle East again to secure an energy supply. If you don't want more war for your kids, you want American energy dominance. So we get our energy here rather than having to depend on these volatile, hostile regimes in the Middle East that are overrun with, you know, militant militias and revolutionary groups and civil unrest or whatever. No matter who you are, having more American energy brings down the cost of everything you buy. It's more money in your pocket because everything's made of oil, your clothes, your cars, your tires, your electronics. But even if you're the kind of person who just doesn't care about money, there aren't many of those, but if you're sitting on a fat trust fund, right? Mom and dad's paying all the bills and you just don't care. so you can afford to support the Green New Deal since you're not paying the bills. Still, you don't want regimes to be ascendant on the other side of the world that have such gross human rights violations and environmental records. I mean, look at the petrostates of OPEC, where we would get our energy if you kill U.S. energy production. What, you want to get your oil from Venezuela, where they're taking people out in the streets and shooting them in the head if they disagree with the dictatorship? Or how about Saudi Arabia, or Iran, or Nigeria, Congo, Angola, Russia, right? Libya. These are your alternatives to getting your energy from America. People think that it's going to stay in the ground and we're just going to use less, but we're not. We've never used less. We have never used less. Look at the trends. Look at the graphs. Look at how much energy you need to run a superpower with an expanding economy that's ever growing. It's more and more and more. It's not less and less and less. And anyone who tells you otherwise is just either not telling the truth, or they just don't know what they're talking about, more likely. They're not so much dishonest as they just don't listen to the Jackie Daly Show. That's what's wrong with them. That's why they misinformed you. All right, and so much more, but those are the basics. And if I can get another guest on the line, we might talk about the largest bribery and money laundering scheme ever perpetrated against the people of the state of Ohio in a mega energy deal, a bust of the Ohio Speaker of the House, Mr. Householder. It's kind of embarrassing for me on multiple fronts. It's my home state. And these are Republicans dealing in nuclear power, getting paid $60 million in recycled and laundered funds to various campaigns and individuals and causes. Are you kidding me? Let me tell you, most of the time when I see a corruption deal like this, nuclear is not the bad guy. They've been on the receiving end of some bad stuff in the past. Let me tell you, nuclear has not been dealt with fairly. But of late, this deal, if you haven't seen it, check it out. Cincinnati.com. Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder arrested in $60 million bribery case. It lays out in detail how much money is flowing through to bail out two nuclear plants in Ohio. And all of you in West Texas who are dealing with that deal for the nuclear storage to come to, you know, a town near you, and I've been helping you, right? Read up on this story, because I'm telling you, this is not an Ohio issue. This is not really a story about Ohio or even nuclear energy. It happens in every state. There's corruption everywhere. Every state has some, probably more than we want to imagine. But this is an example of how something like this can be set up and run. So keep your eyes open. Here's a word from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which exists to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but on this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org. Again, lifepowered.org. I have a steady stream of life-powered experts and content on this show each week, because just like my show, Life Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to our kitchen table. Energy fuels what is possible, the freedom to go where we want, live where we choose, and enjoy the things that we love most. Human flourishing depends on energy use, often in invisible and unnoticed ways. Reliable energy supply can feed the hungry, take care of the sick, and ensure a prosperous economic future for all of us. It promotes freedom and independence around the world and here at home. And fossil fuels don't just power your car and heat your home. They are the building blocks of 60% of all fibers and 100% of all plastics. They're used to create the fertilizers that produce food for half of the world. The U.S. has the means to lead the world in energy production. Through our ingenuity and innovation, responsible production of reliable energy will make the world safer, the environment cleaner, and each and every one of us more prosperous. If you want to know more about how this works, check it out, lifepowered.org. That's lifepowered.org. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Subscribe for free at Stitcher, iHeartRadio Podcasts, and most other places quality podcasts are found. Listen, I have not talked to you in a long time about this whole Russia conspiracy theory that is being pushed heavily again during the political conventions that apparently, they claim on MSNBC that Russia helped Trump in the 2016 election. I think I can conclusively prove to you that Russia would never help Trump. Never. Because he promised to bolster their competitors, their top competitors, U.S. oil and gas companies, whereas his opponent, Hillary Clinton, and now Joe Biden, promised to do everything they can to destroy U.S. oil and gas production. Things like banning fracking, things like implementing the Green New Deal, things like carbon taxes, methane emissions, anything you can imagine that would cripple U.S. oil and gas, Hillary and Biden were in favor of, and Trump opposed. Trump said, if you elect me, I will hit the accelerator every way I know how to permit U.S. oil and gas to increase its production as high as they want to go. And as a result, we are the number one oil and gas producer on Earth. We are in front of Russia and Saudi Arabia, the other two major producers. Okay, just hang with me for a second, and this will all become so obvious. All right, Russia is a petrostate, in truth. What I mean by that is they rely on oil and natural gas to survive. It is their number one export by far. Their economy is propped up on oil and gas. It's nothing like here. In the United States, something like 8% of our economy is oil and gas production. The rest of it is, you know, big tech, manufacturing, insurance, banking, all kinds of things, right? All the other sectors of the economy. Russia is not as diversified. You take countries like the OPEC countries, they're almost not diversified at all. Oil and gas is the only game in town or in the country. So when the United States comes on with the fracking revolution, pushing its production from 5 million barrels a day up to, you know, sometimes as high as 11, 12, 13 million barrels a day, it tanked the price of oil and natural gas. Tanked. Okay, if the only product you're selling or exporting of any significance is oil and natural gas, and the price tanks from $104 a barrel when I started my show in 2014 down to $26 a barrel in February 2016, and now we're down to like 42. If the price of the only thing you're selling gets cut by more than half, what happens to you? You financially die. So when OPEC said, it was a few years ago when the prices were tanking, they announced, we're not going to cut anything because they wanted to destroy and starve out their competition like Russia. The Russian ruble, their currency, fell about 50% over the course of 2 months after that announcement. So I'm trying to say that the fortune of Russia rises and falls on the price of oil. So you and I see the price of oil on Fox Business every day. It's just kind of there. You know, for most Americans, it's like, okay, What am I paying for gasoline? I don't know. Let me look at the oil price. That's a pretty good indicator. For Russia, for Vladimir Putin, that number is the end-all be-all. It determines whether or not Russia faces state failure, whether or not they default. It is everything to them. This is why they have their hands in so many conflicts around the world. This is why you see them in back in the Middle East now for the first time in decades, because we kicked them out. Wherever there is oil, natural gas, pipelines in particular, they will be there. They'll be there militarily. They will be there undercover. They will be there because the more conflict there is, the more war there is in oil-producing countries, the more oil production gets knocked offline, which means the supply goes down and the price goes up. So all of our lives, the Middle East has been in a state of warfare. Why? Because that's how oil-producing dictators and tyrants line their pockets. All you need is one war or one, you know, civil war in these countries to knock off their production, and everyone makes money. Everyone else makes money. That has been true all of our lives until the U.S. shale revolution, which kicked off somewhere around 2005 to 2008. This changed everything. Now, you can have as many as five wars going on in the Middle East and North Africa at one time, and the price of oil still doesn't go up. So it's taken away the incentive of countries like Russia or Saudi Arabia or Iran to gin up warfare to make money. It is no coincidence that warfare in the Middle East has seemed to be incessant throughout our lives. There's a reason for that, a really good reason, because countries like ours, which are the big consumers of oil, I mean, we die without it, right? The economy stops now. There is no transportation without oil. There is no plastics, no vinyl, no pharmaceuticals, no cosmetics, no nothing. We have to have 20 million barrels a day. That's a lot. The world produces about 100 million barrels a day. And by the way, the demand has only gone up and up and up. But you see what I'm saying? Understand this. The Wall Street Journal just published, I'm so happy, brand new numbers on exactly how high the price of oil needs to be for various oil-producing countries to meet their budget. Okay, because they pay their budget, they pay for everything with oil revenues. Listen to this. Okay, And by the way, before I get started, this would never happen in our country, right? You'll never see the United States on this list. The U.S. does not own its oil. The government doesn't own the oil. The private businesses do. So we don't rely on oil to balance our budget at all. But these countries do. In the UAE, they need $64 a barrel just to break even and pay their bills, pay their budget, pay their health care, pay their welfare, pay for their transportation, all the things the government does. Russia reports that they need $42 a barrel to do that, but other people who are not part of their government, like RBC Capital Markets, says it's more like $65 a barrel. So again, oil right now is at $42 a barrel, and it's been low since the shutdown, which was devastating to all oil producers. Russia needs $65 a barrel to stay alive. We're nowhere close to that. Kuwait needs $71. Iraq needs $83 a barrel to meet its budget. Iran needs $91 a barrel. Saudi Arabia needs $94 a barrel. Venezuela needs $359 a barrel just to stay alive and make their budget. Obviously, that is not going to happen. The one thing that could happen, what we call the black swan event, to make oil prices really go up no matter what, is if Iran and Saudi Arabia went to war. With two producers that big, if they knock production offline, and you've seen the production in Saudi Arabia be knocked offline by Iran earlier in the year in a complete act of warfare, you've seen sabotage against the Iranians. That's what this is all about. It's not about hatred and just strife. This is about making money. Please understand. So is Russia going to help the candidate that promises to maximize U.S. oil production, tanking the price of their product? Or are they going to support the candidate that promises to choke their top competitor any way possible? Think about it. I've been saying this till I'm blue in the face since the 2016 election. And I'm not sure I'm getting through. I'm really not sure that people understand this. It would be suicidal for Russia to support Donald Trump. Suicidal. In fact, they're on the path right now. They've barely survived 4 years of him. They will not survive in their current form 4 more years. They won't. Can someone, please, I want you to write to me. If you can name one reason why Russia should have it in their best interest to support Trump, please write to me. I can't wait to hear from you. Find me on social media. I'm on Parler at Jackie Daly Show. Find me on Facebook, The Jackie Daly Show, where you can message me. Find me on Twitter, either Jackie Daly Show or at Jackie Daly Host, or on Instagram. I am easy to find. This is Jackie with no E. Daily is an everyday. If you can name one reason why I should believe Vladimir Putin is helping Donald Trump, I mean a policy reason, okay? A self-interested reason that benefits Russia, please write to me and tell me about it. I cannot wait to hear what you can possibly concoct. Please. You know what? I might even have you on the show, okay? If you're respectful and not foul-mouthed and nasty, I might even debate you on my show, okay? Just write to me. All right, I'm taking a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Listen, California, like Europe, can always be counted on to go first with really bad politics, policy, governance, behavior, and we can all just watch them from afar, just floundering and flailing, and then know exactly what not to do, right? So my friend Chuck DeVore, who is the director of national initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and who happens to be a former California legislator, reminds us in a recent piece that he wrote that California blackouts display the results of Kamala Harris's favored energy policy, and at the most embarrassing time possible, because it happened right during the Democrat National Convention. And while I would never tell you how to vote, ever, I do think that we need to know, we must know, what these two campaigns would give us in terms of energy policy, you know, the love of my life. So Chuck DeVore is back on the show. Chuck, welcome back.
Hey, great to be back.
So Chuck, do we have a friend inside the California utilities that is like kicking off the electricity during the Democrat National Convention just to help us out here? Or was this just really like God raining down judgment on California for all the bad things they've done with energy policy? I mean, how did this happen so perfectly during that convention?
Well, generally in California, the hot months of the year are going to be in August and often in September. And what often happens in California when it's really hot, and this also happens in Texas as well, is that the wind power in the state doesn't really perform all that well. Generally speaking, around the world, wind power is more common at night, you know, sadly, when it's less needed for the grid. And California is no exception. But generally, you get some wind power during the middle of the day. Well, often during hot spells, you don't really get much of all, you know, any wind power. And so that would be a big enough problem, Jackie. But an even bigger problem is that California has been making so much mandated and subsidized solar energy that it sells to the surrounding states often for nothing. that it's been putting out of business the natural gas and coal-fired plants in the adjacent states. And those are the very plants that California relies on to keep the air conditioning running during a heat wave.
Right. So the grid is actually connecting California to these other states, meaning when California makes a bad call, like they most often do, they're not just impacting themselves with a problem, right? They're impacting their neighbors.
Well, right. And according to California law, this is not just policy. This is in their law that they intend to essentially dictate to the other 13 states in the Western Interconnect, as well as Canada and Mexico, the energy mix in those other states.
Is that legal?
They are the biggest electrical importer in the country. And so it's kind of like, well, if you want to sell to us, this is what you have to do. Now, this started when I was in the legislature back in 2006. There were two bills passed, one that was very well known and the other that was actually just as consequential and not nearly as well known. The well-known one was the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006. And basically, it's California saying that we're going to save the world, that we, with this tiny fraction of the world's population and of the world's GDP, that by ourselves, we think that we can slow and reverse global warming. So this is what we're going to do. The other bill, though, banned the renewal of contracts to import coal-fired electricity from places like Arizona and Utah and Wyoming. And then eventually there was another law passed that expanded that to municipal utilities like the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. They were included under that ban as well. And so what you found, Jackie, is within a few years, the nation's largest coal-fired power plant out in northeastern Arizona, in Page, Arizona, that employed hundreds, if not thousands, of mostly Navajo and some Hopi Indians who both mined the coal and operated this huge coal-fired power plant, that you saw California divesting itself of that plant, and now it's closing. Well, that plant provided in excess, as I recall, 2,000 megawatts, which California could have desperately used last week as it was enacting the first rolling blackouts since 2001.
Well, and you refer to these blackouts as the first intentional rolling blackouts since 2001. And as I read on in your article, because I thought, what exactly does he mean by intentional? You kind of unraveled that mystery. But explain that. Like this, this is not the same as just we used too much and we blew a fuse, right? This is actually human beings making deliberate strategic decisions to cut power to their people. Is that right?
Right. So what has happened in the past is there's been circumstances in California, and you're seeing it right now, where because of bad forestry policy, which of course is exclusively blamed on global warming, not bad forestry policy, the California forests have overgrown. And there's a lot of power lines that crisscross northern California through these dense forests, some of which have been blamed for causing fires that have killed people. Now, that's a whole other issue because, of course, the California regulators have denied requests from that utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, to upgrade and improve the safety of those power lines, preferring instead to keep power rates as low as possible because it's hard to cover for all the expense of wind and solar. So, power lines aren't sexy, wind and solar is, so we're going to force you to spend on that, not on power lines, right?
You only spend on what's sexy. Yes.
Right. So then what happened during some of these forest fires is that PG&E was forced to preemptively cut off electricity to quite a few of their customers to prevent the possibility of the mal-maintained power lines in these high wind environments causing sparks and causing fires. So that's happened in the past, in the recent past. But this time what happened was because there wasn't much wind and because there was a tremendous demand for electricity as the state was undergoing a heat wave that lasted several days and throughout the West. So, of course, other Western states had high energy demand as well. And so what had happened was, not only was there less electricity being generated in California, but there was less available electricity in the surrounding western states to feed into California. And then here's another challenge. Power lines are kind of like freeways. You can only put so many electrons on a power line, and eventually it gets congested. And you can't even get enough energy into the state, even if you had the spare capacity in other states. So all of those things fed together, causing there to be not enough electricity in the state to use. And so therefore, they had to institute some rolling blackouts, what they call demand management. That's the euphemism they use when they cut you off.
Yeah, your demand just ended for a moment or a while. Right. So says they.
Yeah.
So, okay, the Secretary of Energy said this morning that California's policy is kind of like saying, I'm not going to own a car, analogized to a coal plant or a natural gas plant. I'm not going to own that. If I need it, I'll just borrow my friend's. But the problem is your friend might want to use the car, right? So if they do, there's no mandate that Arizona sell its energy to California, is there? I mean, they can use their own first, or
well,
is it private sector?
Again, here's the problem. You have something called the Western Interconnect. It's the entire grid of these 13 states in California and parts of Mexico and Canada. And it's the grid itself that you have to keep energized. It's not like Texas, where Texas has its own grid that serves, of course Texas does, right? It serves about 85% of Texans. And there are portions of Texas that are in the Eastern Interconnect and the Western Interconnect. But really, there are only three grids in the United States, East, West, and Texas, which, again, is as it should be, of course. So the problem is that Arizona and Utah are not isolated from California. They share the grid. And so if that grid becomes unstable, then it's going to affect everybody. And so this is an ongoing problem because as California, again, mandates more and more renewable power that cannot be dispatched. In other words, you cannot rely on it to provide power 24/7, 365 to the grid. And the way electricity works is the moment it is demanded, it must be generated. Those things always have to balance out perfectly. You can't store it up unless you have huge battery banks, right? And so what's been happening then in California is because they're subsidizing wind and solar, you have all this cheap solar power that is produced during mild, sunny days in California where they're not using the air conditioning that much. And in places like Arizona, those utilities have to buy, first in line, they have to buy that cheap solar power. And what ends up happening then is it undermines the economic viability of those reliable power plants that use nuclear power or coal or natural gas, and it puts some of them out of business. And the reason why that's bad is when you have a hot day, then you don't have enough power available for everybody.
We're talking to Chuck DeVore, and he is the Director of National Initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Conversation with Chuck DeVore, who is the Director of National Initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And we just reviewed in the last segment, if you're just joining us, California's blackouts and how they are the, first of all, intentional, by design result of California energy policy. They actually do it on purpose because they have to. And one thing that was not that we didn't really delve into last segment is the fact that Kamala Harris stands by the policies that give us this result. She also was a supporter of the Green New Deal. So she was right there, right next to AOC, who, to be fair, might not know better, but Kamala Harris does. And we know she does because California has a high-speed rail debacle that the rest of the country barely knows about that Kamala Harris would, I think, be gleaming about, just beaming about, because, after all, it's kind of consistent with Green New Deal. And Chuck DeVore used to be a legislator in California, so he knows about this. Chuck, we've talked about it before. It's been a long time. But essentially, you explained to us last time, there was a train that was supposed to go from San Francisco to L.A. Now it's just going from Bakersfield to Merced. And it was going to cost $33.6 billion. Now we're up to $98.1 billion. The way government works, right? We've tripled the cost. And, of course, this train would run on electricity if California had any. So, you know, so
yeah, exactly.
To even put this into perspective, because I think, Chuck, when we talk about billions and trillions, a lot of people don't really understand those numbers. I don't think that the schools teach that anymore. Okay, a billion is 1,000 millions, and a trillion is 1,000,000,000. So, Harris's, you know, California train, $98.1 billion. Green New Deal, trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions. All right, so Chuck, explain why we should not support projects like the California bullet train. And because people don't know what a disaster this really is, but please share with us what happened.
So the California High-Speed Rail project is fascinating because it was advocated by all of the corporate and labor interests that stood to make a lot of money. So it was the quintessential crony corporatism project. And they prevailed upon the legislature to write up language that would have California borrow almost $10 billion in bonds to start the construction of this high-speed rail project that would be run by government. And it was supposed to be on the ballot, I think back in 2002 or 2004. They did some polling. They knew it wouldn't do well. They delayed it to 2006. They delayed it again to 2008. And the thought was that with Barack Obama on the ballot, hey, we finally have our chance. You know, we'll have enough voters all excited about Obama running for president that we can finally get this turkey passed. And so it barely passed. I was on the official ballot opponent to the measure, so my name appeared in the ballot pamphlet, and I wrote one of the arguments against it.
That's awesome.
And at the time, they promised Californians that this was only going to cost some $33 billion, that it would use no tax money, no tax increases, that there'd be all this private investment that would come in and help finance it, and the federal government as well. And that, therefore, California would only have to spend the $10 billion it would borrow. Well, in fact, there hasn't been one nickel of private investment that has been put into it. The federal government put about $3 billion into it and is asking for about $1 billion back because California reneged on the promise that they were going to build this high-speed rail 380 miles from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And now they're only going to build 140 miles from Bakersfield to Merced. Well, that's not what the federal government agreed to.
No.
Right? And so the whole thing is collapsing. And anyone who knows anything about California geography knows that where the train is running is the breadbasket of California. That's where all those fruits and vegetables get grown in California. And Bakersfield is certainly one of the bigger cities of California, but the area that it's in is largely agricultural. There's not a lot of the state's population that lives from Bakersfield to Merced. And so you're not even going to get the sort of ridership that they had promised. And they had also promised, Jackie, by the way, that the cost of a ticket would be less than a cost of flying Southwest Airlines from Los Angeles to San Francisco. Well, then, of course, that ended up being a lie as well, because we saw that the ridership projections kept plummeting. Therefore, the ticket cost had to keep going up. And lastly, what's happening, another violation, another lie that was fed to the voting public, is that California, first under Jerry Brown and now under Governor Gavin Newsom, are using the cap and trade fees from increasing the cost of energy to help subsidize this high-speed rail. So it is, in fact, using tax money to carry forward. Now, I don't think the thing is ever going to get built. I mean, that's the thing I've been claiming for years, is that the economics just didn't pencil out. And so think of it this way. If AOC, right, if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's grand idea of a Green New Deal which countenance shutting down commuter airline routes all over the country, shutting down privately owned automobiles, and instead relying on a massive investment in high-speed rail crisscrossing the country, kind of like in Western Europe, where you see that a bit, right? If it can't be done in California, the wealthiest, most progressive state in the country, then how in the heck can we expect this thing to roll out in the rest of the country and be efficient and cost-effective? I think it's just it's a boondoggle beyond imagination.
Well, and yeah, not only California, you know, being optimal, but San Francisco to Los Angeles. I mean, two cities not that far apart geographically compared to like Europe, you know, what they can connect. And it won't even work there. And I was going to ask you, like, who's going today from Bakersfield to Merced? I don't know. Probably not very many people. In fact, I'd never even heard of Merced until I read your article. I don't even know where it is. And so, yeah, if you're making the best point there, which is that if you can't make it work there, there's no way people from Southern Ohio, where I'm from, are going to dream of giving up the independence of their vehicles, you know, driving in their car of their choice with their temperature and their music playing to what, shared germs, you know, on public transport, on a high-speed rail. So anyway, it's a cultural thing.
One thing about Merced, by the way, it's a beautiful town of almost 84,000 people, and it's known as the gateway to Yosemite. So you know, it's a delightful little town, but it's little, and it can't exactly sustain a huge amount of ticket sales for this high-speed rail.
No, and again, I think that one thing we see from the polls is that no one understands the true price tag of these green policies. Your example here, the project cost tripled, even though the route changed dramatically. Should have been cheaper, I would think, from $33.6 billion to $98.1 billion. And again, kids, a billion is 1,000 millions. That's a lot of money. And now you get the feds coming in to pick up tabs, and you get the taxpayers of California piling on, trying to pay the bill. And they probably will be paying the bill for a while. If this, even though the train's not even real, right? It's not even functioning. It's not even happening. And how long did you say this has been going on, Chuck?
Well, the ballot proposition passed in November of 2008.
Man. Wow. Yeah, Californians will die waiting. They have died waiting, in fact, for this train to be built. We're talking with Chuck DeVore, and he is the Director of National Initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Chuck, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Here's a word from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which exists to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but on this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org. Again, lifepowered.org. I have a steady stream of Life Powered experts and content on this show each week, because just like my show, Life Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to our kitchen table. Energy fuels what is possible, the freedom to go where we want, live where we choose, and enjoy the things that we love most. Human flourishing depends on energy use, often in invisible and unnoticed ways. Reliable energy supply can feed the hungry, take care of the sick, and ensure a prosperous economic future for all of us. It promotes freedom and independence around the world and here at home. And fossil fuels don't just power your car and heat your home. They are the building blocks of 60% of all fibers and 100% of all plastics. They're used to create the fertilizers that produce food for half of the world. The U.S. has the means to lead the world in energy production. Through our ingenuity and innovation, responsible production of reliable energy will make the world safer, the environment cleaner, and each and every one of us more prosperous. If you want to know more about how this works, check it out, lifepowered.org. That's lifepowered.org. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Follow me on Instagram and on Parler, P-A-R-L-E-R, the free speech alternative to other social media, which shall remain nameless. I'm there at Jackie Daly Show. So the Life Powered Initiative at Texas Public Policy Foundation has published three reasons American energy dominance benefits your life. I can think of a dozen reasons, but these are three of the big ones. And Jason Isaac, who runs the show at Life Powered, is here to tell us what those three reasons are. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jackie. Great to be on.
So you say here, CNBC reports that the U.S. will soon surpass Russian oil exports and could give Saudi Arabia a run for its money soon after. But why should Americans care is the question.
Well, it's an opportunity to create more American jobs. We produce the energy cleaner than anywhere else in the world. So if you really want to improve the environment, we should be improving and exporting and producing more American energy and getting that energy around the world because other countries don't produce it the way we do. And if you want to lift everybody out of poverty, we've got about 1 billion people that are in extreme poverty left in the world. It's about 10% of the population, a little bit more. We can pull those people out of poverty with American energy. And there's three great reasons right there why we need to be supportive of American energy.
Yeah, I really think we can make the argument that producing cheap, reliable energy that you can transport, like gas, natural gas, or oil for transport, might be the most humanitarian thing that we can do as a country at the UN. Wouldn't it be amazing if they explained that transporting energy to the third world would be the most humanitarian thing we can do? I mean, let's think about it. What even comes close, Jason? I mean, they have vaccine programs, right, to end malaria. UN peacekeepers who miserably fail. Can you think of anything that would be more important than getting electricity to the hospitals in the third world?
Nothing would be more important. You start to raise the economies of these developing countries, the people get wealthier, then they can afford health care. They start to worry about their environment. They start to handle their waste and manage that properly. That is the key to ending global poverty and improving the environment around the world, is to get people access to affordable, reliable energy.
Well, and the way that you put it, too, and I've heard Rick Perry say the same, is that it spreads freedom around the world. That is, the American export of oil and gas exports freedom around the world. Can you explain that?
Well, the terms that I like to explain it in is, imagine women walking to collect water, and there's a great UNICEF video. It's about a 2-minute-long video where they follow a 13-year-old Ethiopian girl, Aisha, A-Y-S-H-A, and her 8-hour journey every day to collect water for her family. She walks with her camel. She walks alone. She's subject to attacks. It's not a safe environment. And energy would absolutely free her from that journey, putting her life in danger every single day. Then after the 8 hours, she's got to walk around and collect biomass. She's got to collect wood, animal dung to burn to heat the water so that they can boil it, so they don't die from diseases like cholera and other things that you get from bacteria that are still prevalent in these developing countries that don't have the access to energy that, quite honestly, we take for granted here in the United States.
Well, and remind me, because the UN actually quantified the number of miles that young women walk every day to collect water. Probably not just young women. I'd say it's older women, too. But how many miles a day in the developing world?
The average for women, so if you look at all women around the world, the average is over 3 miles a day. And Jackie, that includes you in that average. But the women that are walking to collect this water in developing countries, it's over 200 million hours a day.
Wow.
Imagine the opportunity that you could advancing your career, going to school, getting an education, serving civic responsibilities and running for office in your communities. There could be so many more freeing opportunities, but unfortunately, women are the ones that are burdened with this responsibility around the world. You hear about programs from the World Bank and others that are wanting to help these countries develop, and they won't make funds available to fossil-fueled projects. It's only for unreliable renewables. And when you look at what's happening in California last week, they're having greenouts, if you will, from their dark energy. It's blackouts because of a dependence on unreliable renewables.
Well, and going back to the women, because I can say I feel that deploying energy is a women's empowerment issue, because it's not a coincidence that it's women whose walks they were quantifying to do this hard work every day. If you talk to your friends who've been deployed around the world, particularly my friends who went to Iraq or other parts of the Iraq's not really a developing world, but especially the more primitive it is in technology, it's always the women who are doing the hard work. I mean, I remember my friends coming back and saying, even in Iraq, the women are out chasing after the kids, hanging up the clothes, going to the market, cooking the food, while the men sit on the front porch and do nothing all day long, And so, I'm not much of a feminist, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, in those environments, the women are subservient. They are not free to do what they want. In some countries, they're outright enslaved to the family they marry into. And so it's not just that there's a cultural choice to do all of this difficult labor that sets them back. So anyway, I'm just pointing out that because I'm a woman and you're not, Jason.
That's right.
I feel that I'm better able to make this point. I would not be who I am, and Kamala Harris wouldn't be who she is if we had to spend 8 hours a day walking to get water for our families to stay alive the way these women do in the third world. So it seems a bit unfair for us to deny them the same opportunities, and it only changes, as you were saying, when natural gas and oil arrive to town. So before we cut to break, I got 2.5 minutes. You also say that American energy dominance shifts the balance of global power in our favor. I love this point. Explain that.
Well, it does. You look at T. Boone Pickens said about 10 years ago, we're witnessing the greatest transfer of wealth in the mankind. And that was when we were importing oil from Saudi and Russia and Venezuela to meet our energy needs here, when we were sitting on a plethora of natural gas and oil that was just untapped. And now we're actually starting to see that transfer of wealth reverse itself, because we've become a net exporter of energy for the first time in 60 to 70 years. And it is. It's freeing to the United States. It's creating economic opportunities. But we are seeing a reversal of that transfer of wealth empowering the United States and not being dependent on hostile nations. We're seeing countries like Poland and India import natural gas from the United States. And I love it, because in Texas, with the oil and gas severance tax collections, you have people in India and Poland that are benefiting from a cleaner, more affordable, reliable energy source, and they're essentially helping fund our roads here in Texas, our public schools here in Texas. And to me, that's just great. Isn't it nice to have other countries benefit and help us with our finances as well? And so it is incredibly empowering to the United States.
Well, and it kind of makes us the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. So all of these years we've lamented being dependent on Saudi Arabia. Now other countries are dependent on us. And as I like to say, we're also the Saudi Arabia of oil now, the Saudi Arabia of nuclear energy, the Saudi Arabia of coal, and gasp, dare I say it, I think we're even the Saudi Arabia of wind in this country, because we have this massive wind corridor, and of course, unwise politicians just keep throwing our money into it after they take it out of our pocket with a tax bill. So I have to cut to break, but when I return, I will continue this conversation with Jason Isaac. He heads up Life Powered, an initiative of the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Here's a word from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which exists to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but on this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org. Again, lifepowered.org. I have a steady stream of Life Powered experts and content on this show each week, because just like my show, Life Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to our kitchen table. Energy fuels what is possible, the freedom to go where we want, live where we choose, and enjoy the things that we love most. Human flourishing depends on energy use, often in invisible and unnoticed ways. Reliable energy supply can feed the hungry, take care of the sick, and ensure a prosperous economic future for all of us. It promotes freedom and independence around the world and here at home. And fossil fuels don't just power your car and heat your home. They are the building blocks of 60% of all fibers and 100% of all plastics. They're used to create the fertilizers that produce food for half of the world. The U.S. has the means to lead the world in energy production. Through our ingenuity and innovation, responsible production of reliable energy will make the world safer, the environment cleaner, and each and every one of us more prosperous. If you want to know more about how this works, check it out, lifepowered.org. That's lifepowered.org. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Jason Isaac, and he heads up the Life Powered Initiative at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And we were discussing last segment the reasons why American energy dominance benefits your life. So, you know, as President Trump is campaigning to continue his policy, not just of American energy security, some say independence, but it's probably more like security. His policy is actually dominance. It's well beyond having what we need. It's about dominating the global trade. And so, Jason, you mentioned that being such a dominant producer, the number one producer, in fact, of oil and gas, gives us a leg up in trade negotiations. And it seems to me like that is our number one tool, or even weapon, against China, which clearly is our biggest adversary. what's the word I want to choose here? We have to address. No one wants to go to war with China. And so we kind of nibble around the edges with trade agreements and economic warfare, frankly. So how, because, you know, China's not a petrostate. How does our oil and gas production impact our relationship with China, or can it?
No, it absolutely can. First of all, it sets us apart with some independence. It helps us produce the energy here. We're already seeing during the last 3.5 years of this reshoring of American jobs, because we have affordable, reliable, and plentiful energy available. When you look at the personal protective equipment that everyone's wearing these days, that is made from hydrocarbons. It's made from polypropylene, which comes from propane, an oil and gas product. That is absolutely necessary to produce that PPE. And we can manufacture that here right in the United States. We've seen a significant number of manufacturing facilities come back just over the last 3 years because we've eliminated regulations. Our government has. The cost of energy has come down, and we've got more of it. So we're not dependent on foreign countries like China to make all the goods that we need and consume on a daily basis. And the more opportunities that we have to get those regulations out of the way, the more jobs we can grow here in the U.S. and bring a lot of manufacturing jobs back. These are great, high-paying jobs. But again, not only do we produce our energy better here, we produce our products better, more environmentally friendly here in the United States. We've had this trend prior to the last 3 years of us exporting jobs and importing the pollution. And I joke with members of Congress that it'd be nice if all the technology the Chinese steal from us if they'd utilize our pollution control technology, but they don't. And we get, unfortunately, we bear the brunt of that. California mostly. 65% increase in ozone in Southern California is attributed to Asian air pollution blowing across the Pacific. It's because they don't utilize the pollution control technology that we do here in the U.S. And so we should absolutely bring these jobs back, the manufacturing back to this country, because like our energy, we can produce it better than anywhere else in the world.
Well, and not only that, our energy costs are cheap. And this is a point that got overlooked in the big NAFTA debates and China debates. I grew up in a Union Democrat, but very conservative area of Southern Ohio. The whole Ohio River Valley is that way. All I heard was how the jobs were leaving and going to China and Mexico because the labor was so cheap by comparison. And that's true. But what was also critical for a manufacturer is oftentimes their number one cost or expense is energy. It's their energy bill. And so I remember when I started the show, and Jason, you'll know this because you were with natural gas vehicles at that time, or you know, promoting the natural gas vehicles. We had this big arbitrage opportunity for LNG where like U.S. natural gas was something between $2 and $3 a unit. And in China, back then, it was $15 to $17 a unit. Man, that's a big difference. If you're a manufacturer and you're paying for electricity, at some point, you might be saying, okay, great, the labor's cheap, but what about my electricity bill and my transportation bill? This is crazy. So do you know, because I actually haven't kept up with this, the difference between the price of U.S. natural gas, which is still very low, super low, versus what you pay for it in China? Or Asia?
Yeah, you're still importing it between $15 and $18, what's called an MMBTU, which is about $2 trading in the U.S. right now, a little over $2. So significantly higher cost. Now, you do have transportation and liquefaction costs to get it over there, but if you could be around $10 to $12, and these companies are exporting it for that much, or that little, if you will, still very competitive on the foreign market, and that's why you're seeing these trade deals with Japan. Actually, China has import terminals for liquefied natural gas, India, Poland. We're helping these European countries become independent from Russian natural gas and with the reliable, stable American natural gas, which is fantastic.
And everybody's making money that way, too. I had the former ambassador from the United States to Panama on the show. No, pardon me, I said that backward, from Panama to the U.S. on the show, as I recall clearly, because he was so hard to understand. It was almost easier to speak to him in Spanish. But he was explaining that the Panama Canal was widened for the first time in its history, right? This is over 100 years when he was an ambassador, and it was done for one reason, really, to make sure that LNG shipments could pass through the Panama Canal, because at the time, it was just too narrow. And so what happened, he explained on my show, is that the shipments from Houston or Texas or Louisiana, really, could now go only down to Central America and the Panama Canal and then to Asia, rather than having to go all the way down, you know, south of South America and up. So now, and that's just a few years ago, so that's a game changer too.
Cut transportation costs significantly, which, you know, is added on to the products that we consume, or people that are buying the products that they're consuming. We're all paying for the transportation of those goods, and when you cut those costs, that's also another major driver. You talk about cheaper employees, cheaper energy, cheaper transportation, and so that just adds into the total cost of the products that we're using.
Yeah, lower prices was one of the reasons, the three reasons you gave that American energy dominance benefits our lives. And from the point you just made, Jason, I have to believe that if we used our own oil and natural gas more than we use that which is imported, which means transported, it almost has to be cheaper in the long run, right? Because We don't transport it as far. If it's right beneath your feet, then you should have a huge advantage in terms of cost. Maybe you move it by a pipeline to get it from where it's plentiful in the country to where it's not. But it almost makes me wonder why we're still, for example, importing any oil when we have so much here, because the transportation costs are so high when you bring it from Saudi Arabia or somewhere like that. Do you think it's all political, or is it just because the refineries don't prioritize American energy first, or what?
Well, it is a refinery capacity issue, and how we've got so much light sweet crude here and we need the heavy crude, and so we do a lot of importing of that from Canada. Our foreign imports have shrunk. When you look outside of North America, I think they're down to single digits now that we're importing, which is fantastic because we are using domestic or North American oil, and a lot of it, a significant portion, is here in the U.S. But the refining capacity and the products that they're making, they need that heavy crude that we're importing from Canada. So that's good for the continent. It's good for Canada. It's good for the environment that we produce it here. I know there was some talk about with the Keystone Pipeline about they're just going to take that tar sand oil, if you will, and export it to China because they'll buy it there and they'll use it and they'll refine it there and will not have near the pollution controls that we have in the United States. So it's important that we continue to import that oil from Canada and produce it and refine it here in the United States. And now with the USMCA, we're exporting a ton of energy into Mexico, and that is great. The president just recently approved two new pipelines between Texas and Mexico, a rail bridge between Texas and Mexico, as well as a pipeline between New Mexico and Mexico, or maybe it was Arizona and Mexico. But that's going to be pipelines that are moving American energy into Mexico, which will help them with cost, reliability, and creating American jobs, which is just fantastic. I think I read just this morning the average oil and gas industry jobs, $108,000 a year United States. You're right. If we can produce it and use it here, just think about the economic development it does. It creates for American jobs.
Well, and to your point, when we say foreign oil, we used to mean Saudi Arabia and OPEC. Now, when we say foreign oil, we're really talking about Canada and Mexico, and I think Colombia. I remember seeing the top three countries that contribute energy to the United States are in our hemisphere, and they're somewhat friendly, right?
That's right.
Mostly friendly.
And now it's going both ways, which is great. They'll send us their oil, and we'll send them natural gas or gasoline products. And so the USMCA, which was formerly called NAFTA, is such a great deal and is really helpful to the United States and to the entire continent.
We're talking with Jason Isaac, and he is the director heading up the Life Powered Initiative down there at the Texas Public Policy Foundation and a repeat offender on the Jackie Daly Show. Jason, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, Jackie. Appreciate it.
You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show. Listening to the Jackie Daly Show. Follow me online, jackiedaly.com, on Facebook, and on Parler at Jackie Daly Show. And you can subscribe for free at iHeartRadio Podcasts, The Blaze Podcasts, or most other places where quality podcasts are found. So I regret to inform you that in my home state of Ohio, the largest bribery and money laundering scheme ever perpetrated against the people of the state of Ohio has just been announced maybe a month ago. This was an energy deal. Okay, it's about bailing out nuclear energy, and the Speaker of the House is the top guy going down, apparently, according to the reporting that I can find, from $60 million in bribery, basically to alter the energy mix of Ohio and who's winning and who's losing in energy. So here to join me to discuss these types of problems is Josiah Neely. He is the Texas director of the R Street Institute and also a senior fellow in energy policy. So Josiah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Josiah, I have worked in the legislature, the U.S. House, and I can't say that this kind of thing really surprises me, but within the world of energy, I always thought of nuclear as being on the receiving end of unfair advantage or favor curried with public officials. Here, I was surprised that they were the guys actually trying to purchase the influence. Were you surprised by this?
So I was certainly surprised by the scale of it. When you hear a bribery scheme, $60 million is a lot of money, even though I guess the Ohio speaker had to split that with some other people. So it's not $60 million just for him, free and clear. But the scale of it, certainly. But it's also not too surprising, because when you have cozy relationships between big companies and the government, and the government has a lot of favors and favoritism that it can hand out to people, it's maybe not so surprising that some people would try and skirt the rules, I guess, or even flout the rules in this case.
Right. Well, this is a anyone who accuses me of being partisan, I'll say it here. He is a Republican Speaker of the House. This is a nuclear energy kind of play. My family mostly worked in nuclear energy in Ohio, both in the northern plants and the southern plants. I've been a huge partisan for nuclear energy. Even though I mostly talk about oil and gas, I actually think nuclear is a great form of energy. It should be able to survive on its own competitively. What is it that's causing nuclear energy to even behave this way, that it would need a bailout?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I will say this is it's a bipartisan scandal, because in addition to the Ohio situation with the Republican Speaker of the House, there's a similar situation going down now in Illinois as well with the Democrat Speaker of the House. Different company has entered into a agreement with the FBI to defer prosecution. They apparently were bribing him too. So they're different nuclear company, but all over the place there are these problems. Nuclear power, as you say, it's got a lot of things that are going for it that are positive. It's a clean, reliable source of energy. It's safe, right? The big problem that nuclear energy has had is nuclear plants, especially the ones that are already online, they cost a huge amount of money. And it takes years and years, decades to get online. And then you are basically at the mercy of the market for decades to make sure that all your projections go out about what the prices are going to be. And fortunately for the American consumer, we have had in this country a major fall in the price of natural gas from fracking, which has brought down electricity prices. It's really good for consumers, but it has left a lot of these nuclear plants in the lurch. It's made it difficult for them to compete in that market. And, some of them have tried to remedy that by having the government step in and bail them out in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we saw in Ohio, where they passed the law HB 6 that actually the nuclear plants in Ohio, this is really the most recent bailout is the fifth time that electricity consumers in Ohio would have paid for those plants, because they were originally built they were paid for through ratepayers. And then since then, there have been four additional times where they have been bailed out by the state. So
mercy.
That's a
questionable business model, in my view.
Well, and there had been a time, right, where the demand, it still is, the demand for electricity is going up worldwide. So in our country, we have our nuclear plants running at about 90% capacity, and maybe a little more. And we haven't built new plants. So technically, you know, they used to run at 50% capacity back in the 50s and 60s. Now they're at 90% capacity. The point being that it's great energy, but we're kind of maxed out. You know, we can't get more. You would think this is exactly the time when they would be competitive. But as we can see, because probably because of you know, government programs and incentives and disincentives and picking winners and losers, which sometimes it's called picking campaign contributors versus political adversaries, right? In reality, they probably are suffering under something of that sort. So let me ask a question, Josiah, a bit of a curveball. Here in Texas, I have been really bombarded with information from West Texas, where we have our largest oil field, and there is a plan by people I know, by the way, to bring nuclear waste to our largest oil field. I am opposed strongly. The people out there are opposed strongly. I've heard from them. I've made videos for them. I'm trying to help. But what's interesting is they, what I hear from them from the meetings they attend, they are convinced that everyone who is speaking in favor of the nuclear storage facility there in West Texas is either on the payroll of someone, just like the Speaker of the House in Ohio, or or something else is going on. Because it's very hard to explain the enthusiasm that all these disparate people have, influential Texans, who are going up against the very influential people of West Texas and the oil and gas producers who are saying, whoa, wait a minute. You know, if we have a nuclear disaster out here, you're jeopardizing the largest oil field in America. Why here? So I don't know. Are you aware of any dynamics in Texas that mirror this Ohio story?
So I do not. I have no information about that. And of course, the issue of where to store nuclear waste is a long and complicated one, where for decades now there has been a site in Nevada that has been selected to store the nuclear waste, but it has not been they've not been able to move forward on that. And so right now the spent waste just stays at the different nuclear plants. I know that West Texas has been looked at as an alternate site, and I believe Secretary Perry has been positive about that. But that also has provoked, as you mentioned, has provoked a lot of controversy, and I think that's in limbo too. So it's kind of a weird situation where no one can finally decide where exactly to put that waste deep down in the ground, where it can't hurt anybody.
Right. Well, and the other thing is it's interim storage. So they double the risk, right? So this is an interim plan. This is not a permanent plan to bury it all in one place. They're going to like pick it all up, and in 40 years from now, move it again somewhere else. So now you have the risk of transportation from wherever it is now to where it's going to be in Texas, and then wherever it goes after that. Why would you move it twice when you could just move it once? So that's another argument. But anyway, I actually digressed a bit from what I was planning, but let me take a break and come back and go back to this Ohio story, because I'm interested in the corruption element, which, I mean, for me, this is not an Ohio story. It's not a nuclear story. It's really a story about corruption, not just in the energy sector, but this happens all the time across sectors. I'll take a break and I'll be right back. You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show, and we're continuing a conversation with Josiah Neely. He is the Texas director of the R Street Institute. He is also a senior fellow in energy policy there. And if you're just joining us from the first or the last segment, or if you missed the last segment, you can find it on podcast. We were talking about what is being called by U.S. Attorney David DeVillers, quote, likely the largest bribery money laundering scheme ever perpetrated against the people of the state of Ohio. This is a situation where nuclear energy producers moved $60 million to bribe the Speaker of the House of Ohio for a bailout and some other people who were lobbyists and consultants. Very high profile, very prestigious CVs. And so essentially they set up an organization to a nonprofit, for crying out loud, to accept funds, which then kicked the funds out to individuals, to campaigns, even in one case, I think, to pay off a home in Florida for the Speaker of the House. Things that should never happen. Okay. So, Josiah, I read this story, and I get PTSD from my time working on Capitol Hill in the U.S. House of Representatives. I believe that for every story like this that hits the press, there are dozens more that never hit the press, that are being investigated, or that are never known, never looked at, that are very similar to this. And so, you know, inside the energy sector, I've often wondered, how are some people getting preferential treatment from the federal government or state governments when so clearly their competition is so much superior, right? Like natural gas, right? That would seem to be the optimal fuel for the world. It's reliable, it's cheap, we're sitting on an ocean of it. How could anyone disfavor natural gas in favor of more experimental, newer energy sources? And why should we be picking favorites anyway, right? Why do we get to pick? Why does government get to pick? But they do, and it doesn't always make sense. Are you aware of other examples inside the energy sector where we see this kind of behavior?
So I have no evidence on the bribery side of things. Obviously, if I did, I would contact the FBI or law enforcement. I will say we have seen similar sorts of nuclear bailout schemes proposed and enacted in New York and New Jersey, which I don't want to cast any aspersions on the fine citizens of New York and New Jersey, but they are not corruption is not unheard of in those states. I will also say that I think there's also, for every example that you mentioned of direct bribery, there is also a kind of soft corruption that happens where these companies and government officials get way too cozy, whether it's through campaign contributions or, you know, a lot of folks work for they work on the Hill, or they work for a legislator, or they are an elected official, and then afterwards they go and get a cushy job lobbying. So there's a lot of connections there, and I think it is natural and reasonable for us to react with disgust to the details of some of these bribery stories. But I think on one level, it is inevitable that when you have the government playing the role of picking favorites, that companies are going to try and influence which favorites get picked to make sure they get picked and their competitors get disadvantaged. And so it kind of inherent of the system, when instead of letting market forces and competition decide the fuel mix for our society, if instead of that you have government trying to direct everything, that is a invitation for this sort of corruption.
Right. Well, and to, you know, keeping in mind that Government is a human institution. It's run by human beings who are fallible, who have character flaws. And here's one example. The conclusion of the Ohio story is a quote from Speaker of the House Householder. And it says this. This is how Cincinnati.com chooses to end the story. According to an excerpt of the conversation in the complaint, when he was reminded that some in the House supported another candidate for the Speaker's job, Householder replied, quote, "Yeah, we can F them over later," unquote. And I'm like, yeah, of course that's what he said. Of course that's what he said. You know, I worked in the House, as I said, under, gosh, one, two, three, four speakers. And then there's a controversy here in Texas about our Speaker of the House who, you know, behaved untoward toward his conference, members of his conference. And now this guy in Ohio, it's like, are all of these speakers cut from the same cloth? Why do they spend so much time punishing members of their own party? I mean, it's just uniform. You know, they're always trying to whip everyone into lockstep. And so, you know, the way this guy talks, right, should remind us, if you turn things over to the government to manage, you're turning it over to people like him. You know, there's kind of a strange blind trust that especially young people have that the government's always virtuous, you know, objective, fair, honest, because it's some abstract idea. But it's really made up of people like this guy. So,
yeah,
what are we going to do about this, Josiah?
You should say, you're absolutely right. The government is made up of human beings, and it's not your grandmother.
No.
That way. It's not the Boy Scouts. So there is currently an effort to repeal HB 6, this law that was kind of steamrolled through to be enacted. I think there's been so much embarrassment over the size and scope of this scandal that the legislature is supposed to come back in this fall and hopefully repeal the law. It's an open question whether they are going to do a straight repeal or a repeal and replace. And if it is a repeal and replace, what exactly does that mean? So when the bailout was originally funded, the way that it was paid for was they took away a number of existing programs for renewable energy and energy efficiency and whatnot, which I personally am not a huge fan of either. So I think that will be a question, is what happens to those? Do those get restored? Do they say, well, we're going to repeal this bailout, but we'll come up with some other way to get money to the nuclear plants? That I think is still undetermined. And I think it's something that we need to watch, because while even if HB 6 had passed with no bribery and above board, everybody, all the people were, you know, just felt in their hearts that it was the right thing to do, that's still bad policy to be intervening in the market like that and trying to prop up these uneconomical plants. So my hope is that they won't take that away only to replace it with something that is equally or almost as bad.
Almost as arbitrary and capricious as letting right. The Speaker of the House of Ohio decide who's going to get a bailout. All right, we're talking with Josiah Neely, and he is the Texas director of the R Street Institute. He's also a senior fellow in energy policy. Josiah, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Here's a word from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which exists to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but on this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org. Again, lifepowered.org. I have a steady stream of life-powered experts and content on this show each week, because just like my show, Life Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to our kitchen table. Energy fuels what is possible, the freedom to go where we want, live where we choose, and enjoy the things that we love most. Human flourishing depends on energy use, often in invisible and unnoticed ways. Reliable energy supply can feed the hungry, take care of the sick, and ensure a prosperous economic future for all of us. It promotes freedom and independence around the world and here at home. And fossil fuels don't just power your car and heat your home. They are the building blocks of 60% of all fibers and 100% of all plastics. They're used to create the fertilizers that produce food for half of the world. The U.S. has the means to lead the world in energy production. Through our ingenuity and innovation, responsible production of reliable energy will make the world safer, the environment cleaner, and each and every one of us more prosperous. If you want to know more about how this works, check it out, lifepowered.org. That's lifepowered.org. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.